This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
So, a couple of other observations then on Calvin's period in Geneva. Not Geneva, Strasbourg at this point. He's entrusted with ministry to the French exiles, and for the first time, he engages in liturgical production. He translates uses the Strasbourg. Sorry, he doesn't do the translation. He uses a translation of a German liturgy in French in Strasbourg. I don't think Calvin knows German, actually. I've never come across any evidence of that. An order, the Strasbourg order, which will later form part of the Genevan order. He also engages there in a worship that is based, the singing is based primarily on the Psalms. Bucer had arranged for the production of a full German Psalter. And Calvin produces his own little selection of Psalms at this point in French. And of course, Psalm singing becomes a great distinctive of the Reformed faith in the, well, really down to the I think probably the early 19th century. Calvin also sees, for the first time ever, he sees discipline being administered along lines that he sort of visualized, but now he sees it in practice. Martin Bucer has a similar vision of the church to Calvin, and sees discipline as something which should reside in the hands of the church and not something that is part of the arm of the state. Bucer is not able to keep the state completely out of church discipline, and Calvin will never be able to keep the state completely out of church discipline in Geneva. But Calvin really gets his vision for that in Strasbourg. Continues being a professor of exegesis, working at the college in Strasbourg, and also produces in 1539 a second edition of the Institutes. And it's the second edition of the Institutes that marks the dramatic methodological shift from the Institutes being a basic, brief, catechetical introduction to the faith to the Institutes being what I regard as an exegetical handbook, really. Calvin was, I think I mentioned this in one of the online lectures. Bucer presents a challenge to Calvin. Bucer is a great exegete, but he's very long-winded. And his style of biblical commentary is to offer a theological disquisition every time a theological locus comes up in the biblical text. Well, that makes your commentaries massively long. Bucer's commentary is not actually as long as Professor Beale's, I have to say. I'm just trying to think on the shelf. Greg seems to have taken it to a next level. You know, obviously, Bucer is the man that he wanted to beat, I guess. But what Calvin does in the Institutes and in his own commentaries, the Institutes are really a way of Calvin lifting out the theological topical discussions and setting them down in a separate book. So, for example, if you were to get hold, if you go home and look at Calvin's commentary on the Romans, Calvin will refer in the Romans to, you know, if you want to see what I say about this subject, look what I say about it elsewhere. The Latin word alibi, we say alibi. What Calvin means by that is, look it up in the Institutes. The Institutes becomes a handbook whereby that which made Bucer's commentaries so long-winded and rather tedious can be avoided. You take all the theological discussion, put it in a separate book, you avoid constant repetition, and you can get on then with a fairly fast-moving commentary on the biblical text. Again, to go back to what I said earlier about Calvin's commentary is still useful, and one of the reasons I think is that they do have, a lot of them, what he described as that brevity and clarity about them. He doesn't waste words. He's trying to give the hard-pressed pastor something accessible to read. Again, a couple of months ago, I was working through Colossians. I sent an email to Greg Beale and Dick Gaffin on a particular point and asked them, and Dick sent me like 12-line paragraph back. It's just great. I bumped into Greg that afternoon in the library. He said, I've already written 90 pages on that in my new commentary. And I said, Greg, I'll just stick with the 12 lines that that Dick Gavin gave me. I've got to preach this thing on Sunday. I haven't even got time to read 90 pages between now and then. So just as a tip, you know, if you're hard-pressed to prepare a sermon, two basic tips. One, Calvin's always good for a very brief treatment of a text that's very rich. And secondly, I know some people are very hard on plagiarizing of sermons. Well, we all plagiarize sermons to some extent. And sometimes when you're hard-pressed for time, you have to grab your ideas in a slightly more raw form from other people than you might otherwise have done. So Calvin then is well ensconced in Strasbourg, very rapidly establishes himself as Martin Buber's talented right-hand man. It's at this time as well, I think, that Buber fixes Calvin up with his wife. 1540. Buber tried several times to link Calvin up. It's kind of funny to think of Calvin being invited to those awkward Sunday lunches where there'd be all these single women around. But that's how he was fixed up. I don't know if it was a Sunday lunch, but anyway, Buber certainly fixed his friend up. A lady, I think I gave you a name in the handout, Idelette de Boer, the widow of an Anabaptist who converted to the Reformed faith. Calvin would also have got his first real taste in Strasbourg of what it was like to really organize a church and get the bureaucracy and the procedures in place. So Strasbourg is a very, very important period in his life. He attends with Buber, they're the Protestant representatives, at the Diet of Ratisbon in 1541, where they engage in debate with Cardinal Contarini. Ratisbon is important because it is the Reformation Council where Protestants and Catholics come to an agreement on justification by grace through faith. So it's very important. And debate continues to the present day over the nature of that agreement. Was it simply a linguistic agreement where both sides still had their fundamental conceptual disagreements? Another argument is that Contarini was actually being set up, that the papacy never had any intention of making Ratisbon a real formal and official declaration of the church. And so Contarini, who was a very gracious man and was wanting to see the church reformed and was wanting rapprochement with Protestants, was really being sent on a kind of suicide mission, whereby whatever agreement he brought back was going to be seen as a hopeless compromise of the Catholic position and was therefore never going to gain any ground. I've always taken the view that it seems to me to have been a linguistic blurring. But my good friend from the UK, Tony Lane, who is a much greater scholar and thinker of the Reformation than I am myself, Tony is convinced that the agreement is actually quite real, that there's real conceptual overlap between Protestants and Catholics at Ratisbon. Normally, I would dismiss that kind of claim out of hand, but Tony's a very thoughtful scholar, and anything he says I would take seriously, even if I was not able to agree with him in the end. So, debate rages. Was Ratisbon, or its other name, Regensburg, was it real agreement or only apparent? Who knows? Whatever happens, it didn't become significant in the later narrative. Calvin at this point is also invited by the Genevans, the old Genevans, to write a reply to Cardinal Sadoleto. With Calvin's expulsion, the House of Savoy and the Roman Church sees a chance for retaking a key city. And Cardinal Sadoleto, again a gentleman of the Catholic Reformation, not a corrupt churchman by any stretch of the imagination, Sadoleto is writes a letter to the Genevans inviting them to rejoin the Mother Church. And the old Genevans invite Calvin to write a response. A couple of things to comment about this. One, that's indicative of the fact that that Calvin's Genevan supporters, this time he's drawing his support from the old conservative Genevan factions, still see him as a great chance to getting him back could be a great chance to consolidate Protestantism. Secondly, the Exchange is probably the most concise book you can read which lays out the difference between Protestants and Catholics at the Reformation. It's really Sadoleto's letter and Calvin's response just lay out the issues very, very clearly and beautifully. I think it's one of the three books that I've said four books you can read if you wish. Even if you don't choose it as your examination book, I think you'd probably find it a helpful book to read because it lays out the issues between the two groups in a very, very nice fashion. Somebody say anything? Oh, somebody was asking a question. Okay. Finally, 1541. Calvin's supporters again gain the upper hand in Geneva and send out an invitation to Calvin to return to Geneva as pastor. Calvin himself tells us how unkeen he was to do this. I would prefer 100 other deaths to that cross on which I should have to die 1,000 times a day, he said. But I was out playing bowls and God told me, you must go. No, the second half of that sentence was just invented by me. But the first half is, I would prefer 100 other deaths to that cross on which I should have to die 1,000 times a day. Well, finally, Calvin is persuaded to agree, and the Strasbourg magistrates are persuaded to let him go. It's worth knowing, he arrives on the 13th of September, 1541. I think we can put the cross on which he's dying 1,000 times a day in a bit of perspective when we look at the deal that he's struck. He is given a free house and double the salary of any other pastor in Geneva. And I'm sure all the other pastors are just delighted to have him back, so they didn't mind him getting paid twice as much as they did. And again, to me, this goes to two things. It goes to, was it really a cross he was dying on? It sounds like a pretty good deal to me. There are people dying on stakes in France, which is Calvin's homeland. They have a tougher call. Calvin's Geneva period is tough at times. But there are others who have much tougher calls in the 16th century. And the deal he strikes, and I think, I can't remember the details, like 800 bottles of wine a year or something. He gets some fantastic wine deal. It's just incredible. He's not a beer man. Herman Seldhaus tells me that beer was not big in Geneva in the 16th century, but the wine. And Calvin gets like as much as he can drink for free as part of his deal. I've never, in my time in presbytery, we've never approved a call with that kind of deal attached to it in the OPC. So, Calvin's back. 13th of September, 1541. and immediately demands that the magistrates establish a consistory to draft regulations for the church. We'll talk about the consistory in a few moments. Within a week, well, just over a week, 20th of September, Calvin presents a series of proposals to the city in Geneva for church reform. I think what you see in these 3 years that he spent away from Geneva, just a leap forward in terms of his administrative competence, his confidence in operating, and his vision for the church. He knows what he wants. Within a week, he's got a draft proposal to go before the council. He wants weekly communion. That is modified by the magistrates to quarterly, because that's what occurs in Bern. Just as an aside, we have monthly communion at Cornerstone. Weekly communion has the great advantage of connecting directly to church discipline. A student told me last year that the pastor of their home church had told them that when they shifted to having weekly communion. The amount of time he had to spend counseling married couples dropped dramatically because people came to church on Sunday knowing they've got to take the Lord's Supper, and there are certain things that apply to that. The Lord's Supper is 6 months away, as it was in the Free Church of Scotland, when it was in the Free Church of Scotland. You know, you got 5 months to fight tooth and claw with your wife before you have to sort of put your, there's any pressure to put the differences aside. So I think probably what's at the back of Calvin's mind, it's not a high sacramentalism, you know, that you're getting infused with grace, but I think it fits beautifully with Calvin's vision for a disciplined and discipling church. That the primary weapon of the church, if you like, is the withholding of the cup and the, of the bread and the wine at communion. And if that's only, I was in a disciplined situation in a church I was at in Scotland where the person confessed to us, you know, the sort of day after a communion that he'd smashed a shop. We'd got drunk and smashed a shop window. And you're left with, well, what do you do? Do you say to him, in 6 months' time, we're going to stop you coming to communion? That's kind of cruel and unusual punishment, to use the constitutional phrase. Weekly communion has much to commend it from a regular discipline and regular reflection upon Christian life perspective. Calvin wants ordination by laying on of hands, which is what he's witnessed in Strasbourg. That's not permitted by the magistrates. They don't do that in Bern, so we're not going to do it here. Crucially, Calvin wants modifications to the appointment of pastors. The way he wants pastors appointed is this. He wants pastors to be examined exclusively by other pastors, and then eligible candidates presented to the magistrates. The magistrates will have an effective power of veto, but the magistrates have no proactive power in bringing a nomination forward. The council changed that to include their involvement via the consistory from day one, right from the start. It also establishes the consistory. And the consistory is one of the sort of genius powerhouses, and Scott discusses it in his book on the Company of Pastors. Consistory consists of the pastors, any number between 4 and 12 of them, and 12 councillors, 12 members who are also elders in the church. And this body was to have power of ecclesiastical discipline and to retain the power of excommunication. It works hand in glove with the council. Adultery. It's a church crime. You commit adultery, then the consistory are going to discipline you. They're going to sanction you vis-a-vis the Lord's Supper. They're then going to hand you over to the civil magistrate, who will impose the civil penalties for adultery on you. So don't think of the consistory as burning people at the stake. Consistory doesn't have the power to do that. Nor should one think of it as operating entirely independently of the civil magistrate. And again, to make a contemporary point, this is one of the things that concerns me about some of the leaps that are made from the 16th century to the 21st century in the realm of two-kingdom theology. It would never have crossed Calvin's mind that basic Christian ethics were not going to be maintained by the civil magistrate. The kingdom of this world, the city of the of earth, still basically ran along the lines laid out by Christian ethics. Adultery is a criminal offense in Geneva, as well as being an ecclesiastical offense. Calvin also argued for ministries. Pastors, who are in overall charge of the church. Teachers, who had primary responsibility for, guess what? Teaching, pure doctrine. Elders, laymen who are involved in the discipline. Well, not laymen, of course, but men drawn from the non-sort of professional religious types. And deacons in charge of care for the poor. Calvin also established a school, which will ultimately become the Genevan Academy, for training up young men, particularly men for the ministry, with a view to sending them back to France. One of the brickbats that's often thrown against the reformers is, They didn't have any, you know, interest in mission. Well, you know, mission meant something different in the 16th century what it means today. Calvin certainly sent quite a few young men back to die in France preaching the gospel. Calvin had a deep passion to see his homeland turn to the gospel. One must also remember that the reformers were by and large fighting for survival a lot of the time. Missionary enterprise is often the preserve of churches that are established and safe. If you're being persecuted yourself, if you're marginalized and persecuted, you don't have a lot of time to engage in missionary activity. So mission activity is fairly limited among the Protestant reformers, but by and large that's a function of their political vulnerability and the fact that the missionary work they did, we often don't recognize as missionary work. We'd see it as church planting in France, but France was a mission field at the time. Great success story of the Reformation in terms of missions was which group? There's only one contender for the crown. There's nobody else out there in the same league. Not the Moravians. The Jesuits. The Jesuits were better. The Tina Turner tract simply the best. That applies to the Jesuits in terms of their mobility and getting their message out in the 16th century. Nobody can hold a candle to the Jesuits in terms of mission activity. That is not to express approval of Jesuit mission activity. It's simply to make the empirical point that they went further, they got more people in more places than anybody else in the 16th century. Consistory was the primary location for discipline in Geneva. It met once a week on Thursday. It summoned people from every class. Scott Manich has done some brilliant work. He's got some great tables in his book looking at, you know, what kind of people were being summoned and what they were being done for. One of the things that most fascinated me was the dramatic contrast between discipline cases in Geneva and discipline cases in Scotland in the 16th and 17th century. Margot Todd, the great early modern historian who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, just 15 miles from here. Margot Todd did a wonderful book on the culture of Protestantism in early modern Scotland. And there's a chapter in that on church discipline. It's fascinating. I wish we could do church discipline now like we did then. You know, for your first crime, you had to sit on this little stool under the pulpit that you couldn't quite balance on, so it was really uncomfortable, looking at the congregation so they could see you and know that you'd done something wrong. For your second offense, you had to stand in the doorway of the church, but just outside, so you were symbolically excluded, so that everybody filed past you and knew that you'd done something wrong. If you're really bad, they manacled you to the wall outside the church. It'd be fantastic to turn up on Sunday, find Justin Poitras manacled to the wall. And of course, you have to remember that discipline in those days had a real bite because these were small, tight-knit communities. And once you're placed under church discipline, that could have social bite as well. You might not be able to buy a loaf of bread. I think that more, you know, people say the internet's changed the church. I think the invention of the internal combustion engine actually transformed church forever, because it meant that if I try to discipline you or you try to discipline me and I don't like it, I just jump in my car and keep driving until I find somebody who will let me in. But in the 16th, 17th century, discipline could have real bite. What's interesting in Scotland is that the majority of discipline cases in Scotland are folk religion. It's interesting on the grounds that I thought that it gives you a very different picture of the Reformation. If you ask yourself, what did the Reformation look like for ordinary people? What did it look like for the ordinary pastor? Not for Calvin or for Luther, but for the guy who's, you know, he's pastoring in Falkirk, or he's pastoring in just outside of Aberdeen or something like that. What was his experience of the Reformation like? What was he having to deal with on a day-to-day basis? Well, it's difficult to know unless you've got records. Presbyterians produce beautiful records. We know that your typical pastor in Scotland, the main problem afflicting his church was not, as you might expect if you read John Knox, that his people were running off and celebrating the Mass down the road with the priest. main problem was that he was catching people, you know, casting spells to make the milkmaid fall in love with them or something like that. There was this confluence of religion and folk religion that at a grassroots level provided Scottish Presbyterian pastors with their primary pastoral problems. What interests me when I read Scott Manich's book was that's not the case in Geneva. The overwhelming number of problems in Geneva are what? Related to what? Not, well, they might have been, but they didn't manifest themselves as money, but probably they're a factor in this. If I could say spoken like a true single person, that gives you a clue. Marriage. The overwhelming number of cases in Geneva are marriage related. Fascinating. I think it speaks to probably a difference in urban and rural culture, that rural culture is more attuned to hobgoblins and fairies and that kind of thing. And it also gives, I think, a fascinating insight into the perennial problems of human nature. You know, this idea, I've tried to go out of my way at points to say, you know, the 16th century is very different. They do things and they think differently there. But there are some hardy perennials. Vast majority of pastoral cases, marriage-related. And I'm guessing that if you talk to most pastors today, that would be the case. Certainly in my limited experience, sex and marriage, they're the big ones. Everything else, sometimes money feeds into those, but by and large, human sin has pretty much the same face now as it had back in Geneva in the 16th century. What's interesting as you read about how the Genevan consistory operates is that you know the popular image of Geneva is it's a little bit like Iran under the Ayatollah Khomeini. There are people doing, you know, spying on other people and getting stoned and that sort of thing. Not the case. Scott Manich's book has done a great job in demonstrating that quite often the consistory operated with great pastoral sensitivity. The weirdest case that pops up, I'm not sure if it's in Robert Kingdon's book or if it's in On Divorce in Geneva or in Scott's book on the Company of Pastors. The weirdest case is the girl who, she has a baby, and I'm not sure if the baby is stillborn or what, but she is lactating but can't breastfeed. And she's caught breastfeeding a puppy. It's kind of weird and rather distasteful episode. But it's exactly the sort of episode that you'd expect, oh man, this is the consistory. All these guys are going to come down on this girl like a ton of bricks and crush her. Actually, they just say to her, you know, that's really antisocial. You know, please don't do it again. It's a sort of wonderfully pastoral kind of response. Another more tragic level, I think I mentioned this in an earlier class to at least some of you, at the center of Scott's book is this heartbreaking case of this girl who she's pregnant and she gets the black plague and she goes into labor in her village and nobody will go and help her. And she's begging, screaming for somebody to give her water, and nobody will leave their house to go and help this girl who I think is just lying in the town square by this point. She hemorrhages and dies. I mean, this is a real person. This really happened. And when the consistory get hold of this, man, they essentially say to the village, if we ever hear of anything like this ever happening again, we are going to come down. They don't use the term, we're going to hit you with the hammer of Thor, but that's essentially the concept. If you ever treat another human being this way again, you will have the full wrath of the consistory and the magistracy bearing down upon you. So the consistory is interesting. It's a serious body, but the rumors and the stories that it always opted for extreme punishments are massively overstated. In actual fact, I often think that sometimes discipline, it would be better if there was a way we could soften the word discipline to include some kind of discipling aspect to it, because they all have the same root, of course. And sometimes the Genevan consistory interventions are definitely more in the discipling kind of way than the ruthless disciplining. They did make some really bad missteps as well. My favorite one is They ban pubs. Amazing. Yeah. What a vote winner that's going to be. They ban pubs and turn these pubs into places where men can go and read the Bible together. I mean, it's sort of wonderfully godly idea. You know, I'm just going out, you know, say to wife, I'm going out for an evening, you know, lads' night out, down the pub, reading the Bible, drinking Coke Zero or something in Geneva. You know, I was going to say Zinfandel, because that would probably have been allowed, even though they banned the alcohol. Anyway, this reform lasts for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they have to backtrack. So they were not all powerful. Attempts, as I say, to ban pubs in Geneva failed abysmally. They knew when they had overstepped their mark at that point. A fair few numbers of the cases did involve disciplining of old Genevans. And I don't mean old as in geriatric Genevans. I mean old as in establishment Genevan families. And certainly, if Calvin accuses his opponents of being libertines, that's the word he uses, and of being sort of loose in their theology and morals, their accusation back to him is that he's using the consistory as a way of getting at Genevan families, that he's prejudiced against Genevans. And there is a perception that the consistory is a French institution. It is of more benefit to the French exiles than it is to the Genevans. Of course, Calvin, we can't talk about Calvin without thinking about the various conflicts in which he engages. I've given you the three big ones on the handout. Sebastian Castellio. Castellio is one of the men that Calvin drafts in to teach at the school that will become the Genevan Academy. And in 1543, he decides he'd quite like to be a preacher. So he presents himself before the consistory for consideration. And in the process of the examination, he rejects the canonical status of the Song of Songs on the grounds that it's a pornographic poem or an erotic poem rather than a statement about Christ and the church. And he also, and perhaps more significantly, rejects Calvin's interpretation of the Creed's declaration that Christ descended into hell. Calvin sees the descent as referring really to the death of Christ on the cross. The sufferings of Christ on the cross. And hell, therefore, as metaphorical. Castellio sees it as literal. I think he's more in line with Luther there. I think Luther is a literal descent into hell man. But Calvin seizes on the Song of Song arguments and makes it a debate about the authority of Scripture. And in May 1544, Castellio is censured by the consistory and launches a bitter attack on Calvin. And here's where Calvin makes an interesting move. Calvin appeals to the magistrate, who also admonish Castellio and then a year later expel him from the territories. What's interesting about that is Calvin appeals to the civil authorities. Here's a man who always claims that church matters are church matters, and he's fighting to keep the state out. But when it is convenient for him, when he can get a quick result, he's by and large very happy to get the civil magistrate involved. Two ways of reading this. One, Calvin's a cynical operator, and he'll get the result any which way he can. Two, he's not a cynical operator, but he takes the view, okay, if you're going to force me to play by these rules, I'll play by these rules and I will use them to my advantage when it is to my advantage to do so. Who knows which? Just an interesting observation. Calvin uses the civil magistrate for a purpose that he theoretically denies they can be used for. Similar thing with the Bolsec affair, Jerome Bolsec. Bolsec establishes himself as a theological teacher outside Geneva. And in 1551, he attacks Calvin's doctrine of double predestination as making the God as making God the author of sin and damnation. After a lengthy dispute, which involves asking for the opinions of other Swiss cities, the magistrates ban Bolzec for life from Geneva and its environs. And Calvin follows through by making his view of predestination confessionally normative for pastors in the Genevan area. The third controversy, Servetus. The big one. You have to search long and hard in Geneva to find the place where Servetus was burned. It's on the edge of a housing estate. Pete Lilbach and I managed to locate it. It's kind of funny because there's this little plaque and it's written in French. So he got down to translate it. And it looks like he's kneeling and praying at the place where Servetus burned. So I took a photo of him and said, I got Pete Lilbach paying homage to Servetus. And, well, he said that he'd make sure I was fired if I put it up online. So I've kept it in my private collection, shall we say. But the Genevans, I thought Servetus would have more play in Geneva as a kind of martyr to liberty or freedom of speech or something, but no. The Genevans are big on Calvin. You get Calvin beer, Calvin wine glasses, Calvin chocolate, that kind of stuff. Servetus vanished from the narrative. Who was he? Well, he was born in Spain in Villanueva in Aragon. And in 1531, we first hear about him in Strasbourg, where he's debating people on the relationship between the divine Logos and the man Jesus. And he writes two treatises at this time, De Trinitatis Erroribus, concerning the errors of the Trinity, and the Dialogi De Trinitati, Dialogues on the Trinity. Get him thrown out of Strasbourg, and he heads to Paris, where legend has it that he did, but he didn't actually meet Calvin. Quick word about Servetus. Servetus is like your ultimate Protestant. One of the things that Socinianism, which is the sort of the theology that ultimately takes its cue from people like Servetus, does is it pushes the scripture principle to its radical conclusion. Servetus wants to get rid of all metaphysics in theology and really just go back to scripture. It's a radical. Servetus is not a rationalist so much as a radical scripturalist. And these guys present a peculiar challenge for 100 years to Protestants, because the principle that Protestants use to refute Catholics, the scripture principle, the unique authority of scripture, is the principle that the Servetus of this world use to refute Protestantism. So it really does drive Protestantism to much greater and more detailed reflection upon the foundations of theology, upon the nature of tradition, on the nature of historical theology, to use an anachronistic term, than they engaged in before. 1540, he turns up in Vienne, the south of France, working as doctor to the local Catholic archbishop. It's one of the things that makes me think he's a bit mad. Why would you want to work as a doctor for the local Catholic archbishop when you're establishing a reputation as the most dangerous heretic in Europe? It's a dangerous place to be. And there he's secretly preparing his greatest work, the Restitutio Christianismi, which is a plea for the restoration of Christianity to its apostolic purity, free from patristic Roman Catholic and Reformation accretions. Servetus at this point sends some extracts of his work to Calvin, saying to Calvin that he might actually find these helpful and they might help Calvin avoid some of the errors that he's making in his theology. Calvin accepts, humbly goes back to the drawing board and reconfigures his entire thinking as a result of this in some alternative parallel universe. In the real one, Calvin sends them back to Servetus, with a recommendation that he should read the 1546 edition of the Institutes, as this would set Servetus right. Servetus then sends Calvin a copy of the 1546 Institutes with his own annotations and an accompanying letter disparaging Calvin's intellectual ability. Not going well, their relationship. It's time for peacemakers or somebody to move in at this point. Servetus, at last, in 1553, gets his work, Restitutio Christianismi, published. That's quite an achievement. Remember what I've said about publishing. Publishing is a little bit then like web work today. Radical guys tend to get involved in it, but also it's dangerous. If you publish heretical material, you are as liable to be charged with heresy and burned at the stake as the man who wrote it. So Servetus, it's one thing to be Robert Stephanus in Geneva, safely in a Protestant haven, establishing yourself as one of the greatest printers of your day. When you're safely surrounded by Protestants, you can publish Protestant stuff. Who's going to publish Servetus? He finally gets somebody to put this thing in the press. And it's here that the story takes a strange turn. There is a young man, Guillaume de Troux, a young Frenchman. He's a French exile in Geneva. And de Troux is a convert from Catholicism. And his parents have remained in the Roman Church and are very distressed about the conversion of their son to the Reformed faith. And they write to him in Geneva, begging him to return to the Mother Church. And de Troux writes back to his parents, saying, "You got a real nerve criticizing me for being a Protestant, when the worst kept secret in Europe is that your local archbishop has the most notorious heretic in Europe working for him as his doctor." By the way, it's quite possible that Servetus discovered the way that blood flows around the body. Generally, I think we give credit to Harvey, but it is possible that Servetus was the man who cracked the problem. Prior to Servetus, I think we thought blood flowed back and out, a bit sort of tidally. But there are references in Servetus' work that apparently imply that he seemed to understand that works that the blood circulated around the body. So he's a very clever man we're dealing with. I think he's mad, but he's a mad genius. And there is a difference between plain mad and mad genius. Servetus' cover is definitively blown. The archbishop has to move against him. He's arrested and imprisoned. And in an interesting showing just how complicated politics are on the ground, Geneva, the Catholic Church, requests that Geneva send evidence to help them convict him, which Geneva does. It's interesting. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, big time, at this particular point. Servetus, however, escapes. I mean, you couldn't invent this stuff. This guy lives this crazy life. Servetus escapes and decides to head to Naples in Italy, but thinks it might be good on the way to stop by Geneva. It's a great place to break journey. Yeah, when your deadliest enemy just happens to be in the ascendant in terms of political power at this point. Servetus stops off in Geneva. He's recognized and arrested. And then, this is a lovely twist to the story. The accuser in those days, in order to prevent trivial lawsuits, this would be a great thing for Philadelphia, really, to prevent trivial lawsuits in the 16th century in Geneva, what happened was, if anybody made an accusation against you, they had to go to prison as well for the duration of the accusation until the trial had been completed. That would put most of the lawyers in Philadelphia out of business overnight, I suspect. So, you know, if I'd got an accusation against you, I'd make Justin Poitras bring it. Then he has to go to prison while the trial goes on. This is just what Calvin does. Calvin gets one of his students to bring the charge against Servetus so that he stays out of prison. And the student is in the clink for a few days. Ominously, this student is not imprisoned for very long. And that is a clear sign of the way this is going down. This is not going to end happily for Servetus. Servetus is tried. Calvin leads the prosecution. It's a civil prosecution. He's found guilty of blasphemy, which is even worse than heresy. And he's sentenced to die at the stake. Calvin prosecutes the case, but this is a civic Genevan action. It isn't Calvin having him in a sort of black ops, lifted from Naples, brought to Geneva and burned at the stake. Civil process. We may abhor it. Being burned at the stake is abhorrent. But Calvin takes the rap for this in popular culture. It is an action of the Genevan state against Servetus. Calvin happens to be the man qualified to bring the prosecution. Servetus is condemned to death and he's burned at the stake the very next day. None of this, you know, hanging around on death row for 20 years while the appeals process grinds through. You're found guilty, you're taken off, and you're burned at the stake the very next day. Calvin meets with Servetus the day before. They attempt to make Servetus recant, and the Genevan pastors intercede for execution by beheading. On one level, it's a fine distinction. The net result is the same. But given the choice, if I had to make a choice, I think I'd go by beheading rather than being burned at the stake. Being burned at the stake was a slow and agonizing process. So that's the Servetus trial. It massively enhances Calvin's power. It makes him a European celebrity overnight. It is for Calvin what the O.J. Simpson case was for Johnny Cochran. You know, it makes him a player internationally. Not only is he a talented writer, not only has he established himself as a great church organizer, he's also the man who finished off Servetus. And you know, he is, for the criticism that's been made of him subsequently, he is lauded across Europe in the 1550s for this. It makes him a very powerful figure in Europe as a whole and within Geneva in particular. Servetus, it's worth remembering, I think is the only man in the 16th century who had the distinction of being burned in reality by the Protestants and in effigy by the Catholics. It was simply a matter of time before Servetus got burned. He was not going to die aged 87 in his bed, a happy, quiet death. The only person who launches an attack on Calvin for burning Servetus is Sebastian Castellio. And Castellio, I think, has the honor of being the first man in early modern Europe to make a case against burning and persecuting heretics. Now, we can relativize that by saying, well, Castellio has a vested interest in this. You know, he's been persecuted. He's not unbiased. But Castellio is a man born out of time at this point and makes the case that theological crime should not be prosecuted as a civil offense. And really, you know, you're then left, it's really where, you know, my own hero, John Owen, in the 17th century is almost the next guy trying to make a coherent case for that. And, you know, what would I say about the burning of Servetus? There's one thing I want to do and there's one thing I want to avoid. The thing I want to do is I want to make the case that Calvin is, what I said to you last week, the normal needs no explanation. It's not abnormal to try a heretic and burn him at the stake in the 16th century. That's what happens to heretics. Calvin is behaving within the conventions of his time. On the other hand, I don't want to give the impression that this is a light or trivial thing, because this is a man's death that's been taken in a particularly horrific and terrible manner. The English invented a more horrific and terrible way of dealing with such people, but I won't go into the details of that today. We'll come across that in a later lecture. So Calvin gains massively from this. And we're running out of time. We'll do libertinism next time. Any brief questions on... Justin.
Just checking here. I mean, I understand the Catholics would have beef with Servetus. I'm trying to find where is this idea...
denial of the Trinity. Sorry, don't mention his crime is he denies the Trinity, and that is considered to be, you know, I suppose it's a question of degree, but that is considered to be beyond heresy. That's a denial of the being of God. And of course, the other thing to remember is that you and I might say, well, Servetus denies the Trinity because he just doesn't understand the biblical text. In the 16th century, no. He denies the Trinity because he wants to thumb his nose at God. Heresy is a moral crime. People are heretics because they are immoral people, not because they have intellectual struggles. Now, I suspect most of us would want to kind of try to combine those two. We'd say the real problem that people don't believe in God is they suppress the truth and unrighteousness. But that sometimes manifests itself in more or less sincere struggles with particular biblical texts or particular ethical issues. There is no, there's no nuance in the 16th century like that. You deny the Trinity, that's because you're a wicked person. To them, it's like being, you're a paedophile. You're not a paedophile because you struggle with understanding the coherence of society's sexual morality. You're a paedophile because you're a sexual predator and you're a wicked person. And we're going to deal with you on that basis. It's the same with the denial of the Trinity. Yeah. Servetus is, he certainly has intellectual heirs, most prominently in the Sozzinis, an Italian nephew, uncle and nephew, Lelio and Fausto, Latin term Socinus, who were, well, certainly Fausto was a Unitarian. And by the end of the end of the 16th century, Socinian writings are having a huge impact in Poland, of all places. These Italians are making the running in Poland. Poland had one of the most radical reformed reformations and seems to have provided fertile ground for the radical biblicism that the Socinians were articulating. Now, I don't know if the Socinians, I don't know enough about Socinianism to say they read Servetus and drew really positively on him. But certainly in later Unitarian martyrology, for want of a better word, Servetus is seen as one of their guys. He was a martyr to the cause. And Socinianism morphs into modern-day Unitarianism. There's that beautiful Unitarian channel to drive down to Philadelphia going along, which avenue? Lincoln Drive. Yeah, the Unitarian church. It's a beautiful building. But sure, it's empty. One of the most depressing things I went to a funeral of a friend of mine maybe 3 years ago. He was a Unitarian. I went to his funeral and it was just, man, it reminded me, if you have a funeral without the hope of the resurrection, that's a bleak funeral. I think Unitarianism is, it has this superficial altruism about it, but it is a bleak, I don't even call it faith, it is a bleak faith. There is no hope in Unitarianism whatsoever.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.